Oriental Muslims. He fed the dreams of the Christians and Jews of finally freeing themselves from Muslim domination. The caliph also tried to use to his own benefit the close ties of the Mongols and the Christians. He summoned the Catholicos Makiha, the patriarch of the Christian church, and dispatched him and a Muslim minister to negotiate with the Mongols. He offered to make a formal submission, pay enormous tribute, and to read Friday prayers in the mosque in the name of the Great Khan, thereby officially acknowledging his subservience to Mongol rule. Huleg scoffed at the offer. He knew that he was already too close to victory to settle for such trifles, not when all the wealth of the richest city on earth could easily be his. The Mongols showed their traditional ability to improvise and use whatever material presented itself as a possible weapon. The largest objects in the vicinity were the tall date palm trees that the Arabs had cultivated and nourished for centuries. The Mongols chopped them down and turned the trunks into lethal missiles that they fired at the city. Lacking sufficient wood to encircle the large city of Baghdad, as the Mongols had done with the cities of Russia, Huleg nevertheless surrounded the city with a deep ditch and a rampart, and began the assault with a terrifying bombardment of the city. The Arabs knew of the use of flamethrowers in combat, but until this point had not encountered the military power of gunpowder. The Mongols had changed the formula of gunpowder to provide enough oxygen to make it ignite in one rapid blast, rather than in the traditional slow burn of the fire lance or of rockets. Such instantaneous burning produced an explosion rather than a fire, and the Mongols harnessed these explosions to hurl a variety of projectiles. Craftsmen made some of the tubes small enough that a single man could operate them and thus fire out arrowheads or other metal projectiles. The explosion in these tubes required a stronger material than bamboo, so they were made with iron tubes. The Mongols attached the smaller tubes to a wooden handle for ease of handling, and they mounted the larger ones on wheels for ease of mobility. Larger tubes fired ceramic or metal cases filled with shrapnel or more gunpowder that produced a secondary explosion upon impact. In their assault, the Mongols combined all of these forms of bombardment in an assortment of smoke bombs, proto-grenades, simple forms of mortars, and incendiary rockets. They had developed explosive devices able to hurl projectiles with such force that they may as well have been using real cannons. They managed to concentrate their fire on one area of the city defenses and hammer it down. The bombardment from such a distance confused and frightened the residents of Baghdad and frustrated its defenders, who had never before been attacked by an enemy too far away to be reached by their weapons. In addition to the gunpowder weapons, Mongol engineers had nearly perfected the use of planted explosives to undermine walls. All of these military innovations complied with the strong Mongol preference to stay as far from the actual fighting and killing as possible. Huleg destroyed the dams and diverted the Tigris to flood the camp of the caliph's army and make them take refuge in the city. The wall of water surrounding the city must have had a similar psychological impact on the people of Baghdad as the wooden wall had produced on the people of the Russian cities. On February 5, 1258, the Mongol forces broke through the walls of Baghdad, and after 5 days, the caliph capitulated. To prepare the city for looting, Huleg ordered the people of Baghdad to surrender their weapons, leave all their goods, and march out of the city. Rather than comply with the order, the defending army bolted and tried to escape, but the Mongols gave chase and cut them down. Huleg sent his Christian troops into the city to collect the loot, but they found many people had refused the order to evacuate and were still hiding in their homes. For disobeying the order, the invaders killed them. By Mongol order, the churches and Christian property in the city remained secure from plunder, and Huleg presented one of the caliph's palaces to the Catholicos Makiha. The Christians inside Baghdad joined their fellow believers to loot the city and slaughter the Muslims from whom they felt their salvation had finally come. Centuries of hatred and anger spilled out as they defiled and destroyed mosques and turned many of them into churches. The Christians celebrated joyously throughout the Abbasid lands and beyond. An Armenian chronicler described the exulting joy. 515 years have passed since the founding of the city, he wrote. Throughout its supremacy, like an insatiable leech, it, Baghdad, had swallowed up the entire world. Now it restored all that had been taken. Now Baghdad was punished for the blood it had shed and the evil it had done. The measure of its iniquity was full. The looting lasted 17 days. During this time, the invaders accidentally, or deliberately, set the city afire. Huleg allowed the Christians to destroy the tombs of the long line of Abbasid caliphs, and then Huleg summoned the captive caliph to his camp outside the city. According to the Armenian chronicler, Grigor of Akats, Huleg locked up the caliph for 3 days without food or water, then brought him out and heaped up his gold and treasure before him. Pointing to the massive piles of wealth looted from the city, Huleg reportedly ordered the caliph to eat the gold, and when he could not, scolded him for so greedily accumulating wealth instead of building an army to defend himself. He then sentenced the caliph and his male heirs to death, but as a final gesture of respect for the high status of the condemned, he allowed them the honor of being executed in the Mongol way, without bloodshed. According to the differing but similar accounts, they were either wrapped in carpets or else sewn into sacks and kicked to death by the Mongol warriors or trampled by their horses. The Mongol army had accomplished in a mere 2 years what the European crusaders from the west and the Seljuk Turks from the east had failed to do in 2 centuries of sustained effort. They had conquered the heart of the Arab world. No other non-Muslim troops would conquer Baghdad or Iraq again until the arrival of the American and British forces in 2003. While the Mongols defeated the Arabs, the Crusaders, who at this time occupied a series of castles and small cities along the Mediterranean coast, had watched the Mongol approach cautiously. Suddenly, with the fall of Baghdad, they saw an opportunity for themselves to ally with the Mongols and share in their victories. When the Mongols left Baghdad and headed further west toward Damascus, the Crusader knight Bohemund of Antioch came out with his army to attack Damascus from the Mediterranean side, and he brought supplies and food to help the Mongols. Similarly, the Seljuk Sultan sent his army from Anatolia to join the Mongol assault. Damascus surrendered and thereby saved itself from the fate of Baghdad. Soon the Mongol warriors were on the beaches of the Mediterranean Sea for the second time. 18 years earlier, in 1241, the Mongols under Bat had reached the Mediterranean via Europe. Now, on their second arrival, they approached it via Asia. In the 7 years since Huleg left his brothers at Karakorum, he had conquered, or reconquered, everything along a distance of some 4,000 miles, and he had added millions of Arabs, Turks, Kurds, and Persians to the still-growing empire. In the 6 centuries since the birth of Islam, the religion had expanded greatly and lost control of a few border zones. But never had so much of the Muslim world fallen under the rule of pagans. The 4 decades from Genghis Khan's attack on Bukhara until the fall of Baghdad and Damascus represented the lowest point in Muslim history. While the Crusaders had only managed to take a toehold in a few ports, the Mongols conquered every Muslim kingdom and city from the Indus River to the Mediterranean. They had conquered almost all of the Muslim lands in Asia. Only the Arabian Peninsula and North Africa remained beyond their control. The gleeful gloating of the Christians could hardly have been greater. An account in the Armenian Chronicle related an apocryphal story that illustrated more about Christian contempt for and mockery of Muslims than actual Mongol practice. According to the story, after his victory over the Arabs, Huleg ordered 100,000 piglets from Armenia and dispatched 2,000 to each Arab city, where he required the Muslim residents to tend the pigs in the middle of their city, feed them almonds and dates daily, and carefully wash them with soap every Saturday. Just as absurdly, the chronicler added that the Mongols demanded that all Arabs eat pork, and that they decapitated every Arab who refused. Although it seemed at the time that the Mongol Empire threatened to swallow all of the Muslim world, the Mongols had in fact reached their limit in the West. The empire would not expand any further in that direction. An army of Mamluk slaves, mostly purchased from Italian merchants, who brought them from the Kipchak and Slavic people of Russia and sold them to the Sultan of Egypt, moved out from Egypt and encountered a Mongol detachment at Ain al-Jalut, the Springs of Goliath, near the Sea of Galilee in what is today Israel. On the morning of September 3, 1260, a year after Mong Khan's death, the Mamluks defeated the Mongols. The empire had reached its western border. Compared with Huleg's military victories and extensive conquests of land and people across the Middle East, the attempts by his brother Kublai to similarly overthrow the Sung dynasty and annex its lands in southern China still remained more of a distant dream for the Mongols than a pending reality. Kublai's apparent lack of military experience stymied fulfillment of his mission. Unlike his brothers who had fought in Europe and the Middle East, Kublai had spent most of his life in the Mongol lands south of the Gobi, where he maintained a personal court that was larger and more luxurious than the imperial court at Karakorum in the Mongol heartland. He enjoyed feasting more than fighting. He grew fat and developed gout, which further impaired his ability to be an inspiring military leader on horseback. After receiving the orders from his brother Mong Khan to move south into China, Kublai's army found modest success. In a series of limited campaigns against border kingdoms to the west of the Sung Kingdom. While openly making elaborate preparations for war against the Sung, Kublai moved very slowly. Not only did he encounter obstacles to extending the Mongol domains, but within his own administrative territory, sectarian violence flared in a struggle for dominance between Taoist and Buddhist monks, further limiting his control over his lands. Instead of sending news of victories and dispatching caravans of tribute to Karakorum, Kublai sent frequent excuses for the delays encountered and unexpected conditions. The generous explanation of scholars sympathetic to Kublai is that he was a mature and thoughtful leader who wanted to proceed with careful organization and not on impulse, and one who combined the best of Chinese and Mongol military strategies and armies. The less generous explanation is that he lacked the Mongol aptitude for war, but managed to avoid failure because of the general momentum of the Mongol conquest and the outstanding martial ability of his generals. An obviously dissatisfied Mong Khan dispatched a series of investigators to look into the problems with Kublai. Finding ample evidence of fraud and corruption in Kublai's administration, They executed many of his important administrators and stripped Kublai of his financial prerogatives and duties. The investigators proceeded in much the same ominous manner that they had done during the purge of Ogaday's family. And it appeared that not just Kublai's power was at stake, but possibly his life as well. Monk summoned Kublai to Karakorum, ostensibly to answer for the fiscal irregularities, but probably to account for a variety of issues, most important of which was the lack of military success against the Sung. Rather than resist his brother, as some of his advisers recommended, Kublai traveled to Karakorum as ordered and threw himself on the mercy of his older brother. Following Kublai's degrading display of regret and fawning loyalty, Mong Khan publicly forgave and reconciled with him. But the incident did little to resolve the underlying cause of the tensions between the two men, nor did it bring the Mongols any closer to the ultimate goal of victory over the Sung. The frustrated Mong Khan had to devise a new plan. In the fall of 1257, while Hulag's troops moved against Baghdad, Mong Khan summoned a small Hurultai to a wooded area of the Horhonak Valley on the old family river, the Onan, not far from the sacred mount of Burhan Haldun. Here it became clear to him, or at least he made it clear to his court, that he himself would have to lead the campaign against the Sung. Mong Khan had served extensively in the European campaigns, and he had been trained under Subuday, the most accomplished of all Mongol generals. And after the death of his mentor 2 years earlier, Monk was probably himself the best general available to lead the campaign against the Sung. For the duration of his absence during the upcoming campaign, Monk turned over the central administration of the empire at Karakorum, as well as responsibility for his son and heir, to his youngest brother, Arik Bok. Mong Khan ordered Kublai to return to his territory to end the clerical strife between the warring factions of Taoists and Buddhists, while Monk took control of the more important military campaign. Monk emulated his grandfather's basic military strategy by first attacking the smaller and weaker areas before moving against the larger target. For Monk, this meant starting the conquest with a campaign against the adjacent lands of Sichuan to the west and Yunnan to the southwest of the Sung, and then slowly capturing the larger prize in the closing Mongol net. If the Mongols could gain control of these areas, they could attack the Sung from all sides at once. In May 1258, only 3 months after Huleg's sack of Baghdad, Mong Khan led his army across the Yellow River. Within a year, they had covered the territory from the cold Onan on the Siberian border to the humid and warm south. After quickly subduing the outlying kingdoms, Mong began to move against the Sung dynasty itself during the second year of the campaign, but the weather became extremely hot. The climate differed greatly from anything Mong and most of his warriors had experienced in Mongolia or on their European campaigns. Many of the Mongols suffered from bloody diarrhea, probably dysentery, and then other plagues. Mong Khan became ill but improved. And then, on August 11th, 1259, he suddenly died. Every chronicle lists a different cause of death. The Chinese reported that he died of cholera, the Persians that he died of dysentery, and others claimed he died from a battle arrow. The death of Mong Khan congealed the empire. Advancement ceased. Rather than racing back home to participate in the selection of a new great Khan, as the Mongol leaders had done after the death of the three previous great Khans, each faction moved to protect the territory it already held. In the Middle East, the newly triumphant Hulek occupied the richest lands and cities of the empire. He controlled more wealth than the rest of the Mongol Empire combined. He had already taken some of the prized Azerbaijan pastures of his cousins who ruled Russia. For fear of losing yet more land to him, his cousins held their territory and refused to return to Mongolia for an election. Neither Huleg in the Middle East, nor the Golden Horde, as Djosh's descendants in Russia eventually became known, wanted to risk losing what territory they already controlled in order to haggle over the supreme title of Grand Khan in Mongolia. The Mongol Empire reached its greatest extent under Mong Khan, who was the last of Genghis Khan's descendants to be acknowledged and accepted as Great Khan by the whole of the Mongol Empire. Many Khans would continue to rule over the various parts of the empire, and of them, many would claim to be the rightful heirs to Genghis Khan and to the title of Great Khan. But no one of them would be recognized by all the other factions and lineages. Mong Khan began, but never finished, the Second Mongol World War. It ended with neither victory nor defeat. It merely flickered out. His brothers pursued episodic campaigns, but they concentrated efforts on each other more than on outside enemies. Kublai suddenly turned his attention away from the Sung to challenge the youngest brother, Adik Bok, who ruled Mongolia from Karakorum. Each of them summoned a separate Hurultai in his own territory. The choice between the two contestants, and more importantly, between their supporters, seemed sharp and clear. As the better educated, Kublai had been given lands in the agricultural areas, where Chinese culture reigned supreme, and he never inspired the full confidence or approval of other members of the Golden Family. Kublai preferred buildings and cities. He seemed as comfortable in a palace as in a tent, and he may have even spoken some Chinese. The deviance from the traditional Mongol life contributed to an alien aura that always seemed to engulf him. In contrast to Kublai's cosmopolitan persona, Adik Bok lived very much as a man of the steppes, the Mongol who seldom strayed far from his horse. As the youngest son, he was the family Ochigen, prince of the hearth, like his father, and he could make the same claim of rights over the office of Great Khan that Monk had made when he posthumously elevated their father to that rank. In addition, Adik Bok inspired confidence from the other members of the Golden Family by posing less of a threat to their control of their own lands, while Kublai's more imperial style invited suspicion. In keeping with Mongol law, Adik Bok held his Hurultai in the homeland of Mongolia. Mong Khan's widow and sons supported him as the legitimate and best heir, as did most other members of the family, aside from his two brothers, Huleg and Kublai. In June 1260, representatives of all the family branches proclaimed Adik Bok as the Great Khan at the Hurultai in Karakorum. But Kublai succeeded in pulling off a coup d'etat. Following the advice of his Chinese ministers, Kublai summoned his Hurultai in his own territory. Aside from his followers, hardly anyone came, but the small assembly nevertheless proclaimed him Great Khan. In order to win the loyalty of his Chinese subjects, he additionally proclaimed himself emperor in the same year, 1260, and he chose the title of Zhengtong, meaning central rule. This title was a Chinese adaptation of the Mongolian designation of the Great Khan as the central camp, and his armies as the left and right. No matter how untraditional his selection may have been by Mongol standards, Kublai exercised strong control over the Chinese army as well as his own detachment of Mongols. More important, he controlled the flow of food that Karakorum needed to survive. The population of the Mongol steppe city had swollen too much to survive on the local herds alone, and the land around Karakorum, despite sustained efforts to encourage foreign farmers, proved inhospitable to agriculture. Without substantial and continual food shipments from the farmlands controlled by Kublai, Karakorum had to be evacuated or face starvation. Kublai cut off the food and then sent his army to capture Karakorum. Arikbok fought hard, but withdrew steadily against the overwhelming size of his brother's Chinese army. Karakorum fell quickly to Kublai, but in 1261, Arikbok temporarily took it again. The armies of the dueling Khans met two more times, but gradually Arikbok Khan's army weakened and began to atrophy as it faced desertions of allies who saw that the younger Khan would never prevail against his older, better equipped, and probably more intelligent elder brother. Arikbok also faced the worst threat to the Mongols, Zud, or animal famine. From 1250 to 1270, Mongolia suffered a lowering of temperatures. In a fragile ecological zone such as Mongolia, a change of only a few degrees in annual temperature severely reduces the small amount of precipitation, restricts the growth of the grass, and thereby weakens or kills the animals. Without strong horses or ample food, the supporters of Arikbok, already cut off from the agricultural largesse of Kublai Khan's territory, proved too weak to mount a sustained war. The winter of 1263 proved particularly cruel, and by the following spring, Arikbok no longer had a viable power base. Unable to feed his followers, Arikbok proceeded to Shangdu, where he surrendered to Kublai in 1264. When the brothers met at the end of the protracted struggle, Kublai forced Arikbok to perform a public ceremony of obeisance. Before the assembled court, Kublai interrogated his brother, demanding to know which of the two sides in the struggle for the office of Great Khan was the correct one. Arikbok's answer showed the strength of his pride, even in the face of defeat. "We were then, and you are today." Other members of the family, including the distant brother Hulek, reacted so bitterly to Kublai's public shaming of his older brother that they complained to him. Kublai summoned another Hurultai on Mongolian territory to decide the fate of Arikbok and to ratify himself as the legitimate Khan without the taint of his earlier election on Chinese soil. Despite the overwhelming military might of Kublai's army, the Golden Family refused to attend. They recognized the reality of Kublai's rule, but none of them proved willing to participate in a criminal trial of Arikbok, whom they had supported as Great Khan. None of them trusted Kublai enough to take the chance of leaving their homelands and perhaps never returning. In the absence of a quorum for a Hurultai, Kublai forgave his brother. Kublai tried and executed many of his brother's supporters, but his only punishment of Arikbok, at least publicly, was banning him from court. Shortly thereafter, in 1266, mysteriously but conveniently for Kublai, Arikbok, still in the prime of life, suddenly sickened and died. He had almost certainly been poisoned. Kublai now held the office of Great Khan. He had the world's largest army under his control, and he ruled one of the most populous nations on earth. The victories had come at a steep price. Some of the Mongol royal family and their followers refused to recognize his legitimacy, or at most, they gave symbolic recognition, but ignored him, and continued to wage intermittent border wars for another generation. Like the four fountains of the Silver Tree, the Mongol Empire now divided into four primary zones of political administration. Kublai ruled China, Tibet, Manchuria, Korea, and Eastern Mongolia. But he faced constant problems in enforcing his rule over Mongolia and Manchuria. The Golden Horde ruled the Slavic countries of Eastern Europe, and they consistently refused to recognize Kublai as the Great Khan. The lands ruled by Huleg and his descendants, from Afghanistan to Turkey, became known as the Ilkhanate, meaning vassal empire. It was here that Persian culture reemerged from centuries of Arab domination to build the foundation for modern Iran. The most traditional Mongols occupied the central steppes, which became known as Mogolistan, and encompassed the modern areas from Kazakhstan and Siberia in the north, and across Turkestan in Central Asia to Afghanistan in the south. For a while, they had some unity under Ogedei's and Torojen's grandson Haydu, who ruled from Bukhara and served as a counterpoint to the power of Kublai Khan. But the area fragmented repeatedly in the centuries ahead. For a mere three decades, Karakorum had served as capital of the Mongol Empire, before the Mongols themselves, under the command of Kublai, looted and virtually destroyed it. In that short time, it had been the center, the pivot of the world. As part of the looting of Karakorum, the silver tree was disassembled and carted away. Part 3. The Global Awakening, 1262 to 1962. Asia is devouring us. Tartar faces in every direction you look. Thomas Mann, The Magic Mountain. Chapter 8. Kublai Khan and the New Mongol Empire. The Great Khan is the mightiest man, whether in respects of subjects or of territory or of treasure. Marco Polo. Kublai Khan's genius derived from his recognition that he could not conquer all of China by mere force, no matter how large his army or sophisticated his weapons. Even without the military skills of his grandfather, he had clearly outsmarted everyone in his family. He possessed a keen strategic talent and the ability not merely to have good ideas, but to implement them as well. He applied these skills to the management of his territory and, most important, to its expansion toward the south. In the end, he proved able to achieve through public politics what his grandfather had not been able to achieve through brute force: the conquest and unification of all China, the most populous country on earth. He won over the population by skillful manipulation of public opinion, in which martial prowess was an important but not exclusive factor. He built a Chinese capital, took Chinese names, created a Chinese dynasty, and set up a Chinese administration. He won control of China by appearing to be more Chinese than the Chinese, or at least more Chinese than the Sung. For most of its history, China had been a great civilization, but not a unified country. While the educated elite shared a written language, classic texts, artistic styles, and other types of high culture, the common people spoke entirely different languages in a constantly changing mosaic of national boundaries and temporary dynasties and ruling families. The educated elite clung to an unfulfilled dream of a united country with all people under a single government. Occasionally, a leader or a family temporarily cobbled together several states, and then offered, once again, the tantalizing hope of making a unified China a reality. In between these brief periods of unification, the concept of China lingered on as an ideal or a romantic image in the poetry, calligraphy, and essays of the Chinese intelligentsia. Like no prior leader, Kublai Khan offered these educated people the enticing opportunity to realize their nationalist desire. Despite his crude origin among steppe barbarians, he proved more capable of fulfilling that ancient dream than the Sung rulers. Everything he did seemed calculated to convince the Chinese people that heaven had conferred its mandate unmistakably on him alone. And in due time, the old dynasty of the Sung would fall, since it no longer had the necessary vitality. Kublai Khan seemed to recognize that he faced many of the same problems of his grandfather at the time of the original unification of the steppe tribes. Namely, how to organize a large number of disparate people into a single, cohesive political entity. Although Genghis Khan had faced the problem with a collection of tribes smaller than 100,000 each, Kublai Khan faced the same problem with countries of many millions each. Like Genghis Khan two generations earlier, Kublai Khan began the arduous process of state-building around a core ethnic identity. But for Kublai, that core cultural identity would be Chinese, not Mongol. He had to win the loyal support of the Chinese people, and he had to rebuild, or in many cases invent, institutions to unify disparate people into a viable and strong working whole. In his struggle for supremacy against his brother Arik Bok in 1260, Kublai had taken a Chinese title that was a translation of a Mongol one. But in 1264, he modified his reign name to Jiwan, meaning complete beginning. And later in 1271, he used this to become the basis of the dynastic name of Dayuan, meaning great origins or great beginnings, by which the Mongol dynasty became officially known in Chinese history. The new name meant not only a new beginning for his Chinese subjects, but it also signified a new beginning for his Mongol ones as well. Kublai was no Genghis Khan, but he had embarked upon a venture no less daunting than his grandfather's. As emperor and founder of a new dynasty, Kublai sought to Sinicize his image and thereby make it not merely acceptable, but alluring to his Chinese subjects. In 1263, Kublai ordered the building of an ancestral temple for his family. He commissioned his ministers to conduct traditional Chinese ceremonies honoring the family's ancestors, but perhaps indicative of the usual Mongol reluctance to avoid anything associated with death, he personally stayed well away from them. By the following year, he erected a series of Chinese-style ancestral tablets to his ancestors. In 1277, after declaring the new Mongol dynasty, he posthumously conferred Chinese names on his ancestors and built a larger temple with 8 chambers. One for the founders of the family, Yesuge Batar and Oilun, another for Genghis Khan, one for each of Genghis Khan's 4 sons, and one each for Guyuk Khan and Monk Khan. In the new official version of the family history, Joch, whose family had been the most loyal ally to Kublai's lineage, was fully recognized as a legitimate family member. Just as Monk had posthumously elevated their father Tolu to the office of Great Khan, Kublai conferred the office of Chinese emperor on him. He ordered portraits made of all of them in Chinese style, so that they looked more like Mandarin sages than Mongol warriors. Kublai acknowledged the utility of both a strong army and good propaganda. But the third element of his strategy came from good administration and policy. Without necessarily following Confucian principles that had high appeal to the Chinese upper class, but less importance to the common people, he strove to install an orderly system of efficient government that could help him build popular support and de-emphasize the foreign origin of his rule. Toward this goal, he appointed pacification commissioners to help restore good relations with Han Chinese in newly conquered territory. The commissioners began by repairing the damage of war and prior neglect to public buildings such as temples, shrines, and structures of deep emotional or symbolic value to the population. To appear as a powerful Chinese leader, Kublai needed an impressive court located in a real city, not a peripatetic tent court or the ad hoc structures erected at Chengdu or Xanadu in modern Inner Mongolia. The place held special importance for him because he had first been proclaimed Great Khan at the Hurultai there, but it had no obvious advantages. Not only was that capital located in a nomadic zone, which the Chinese found quite alien and barbaric, but it had also been the traditional staging area used by his grandfather in the raiding and looting of Chinese cities. Kublai sought to disassociate himself from the less desirable aspects of that history. While keeping Chengdu as a summer home and a hunting preserve, he commissioned the building of another city, a real Chinese-style imperial capital, farther south, at a place better situated to exploit the agricultural wealth of the lands along the Yellow River. He chose the site of the former Jurchid capital of Chengdu, which had been conquered by Genghis Khan in 1215, the year of Kublai's birth. In 1272, Kublai ordered the building of his new capital, and he connected it by canal to the Yellow River. The Mongols called the place Khan Balik, the city of the Khan. His Chinese subjects called it Dadu, the great capital, and it grew into the modern capital of Beijing. Kublai brought in Muslim architects and Central Asian craftsmen to design his city in a new style that offered more of a compromise between the tastes of the nomadic steppe dwellers and the sedentary civilization. In contrast to the maze of winding alleys in most Chinese cities of the era, Kublai's capital had broad straight streets run on a north-south axis with east-west streets perpendicular to them. The guards at one gate could see straight through the city to the guards at the opposite gate. From the imperial palace, they built boulevards, more to accommodate the horses and military maneuvers of the Mongols than the wheelbarrows or hand carts of the Chinese laborers. The boulevard stretched wide enough for 9 horsemen to gallop abreast through the city, in case the native people rose up against their foreign rulers. Furthering the Mongol interest in profits from international trade, Kublai Khan designated sections of the city for Middle Eastern and Mongol populations, as well as for people from all over what is today China. The city was host to merchants from as far away as Italy, India, and North Africa. Where so many men lingered, as Marco Polo pointed out in great detail, large numbers of prostitutes gathered in their own districts to serve them. Scholars and doctors came from the Middle East to practice their trades. Roman Catholic, Nestorian, and Buddhist priests joined their Taoist and Confucian counterparts already practicing in China. Muslim clerics, Indian mystics, and, in some parts of Mongol China, Jewish rabbis added to the mixture of people and ideas that thronged the empire. Far larger than Karakorum, but with many of the same internationalist principles, the city was a true world capital, and fit to be capital of the world. Ultimately, at the heart of the city, however, Kublai created a Mongol haven where few foreigners, including Chinese, could enter. Behind high walls and guarded by Mongol warriors, the royal family and court continued to live as Mongols. The large open areas for animals in the middle of the city had no precedent in Chinese culture. This forbidden city constituted a miniature steppe created in the middle of the Mongol capital. During the Mongol era, the whole complex of the Forbidden City was filled with gurs, where members of the court often preferred to live, eat, and sleep. Pregnant wives of the Khan made sure that their children were born in a gur, and the children received their school lessons in the gur as they grew up. While Kublai and his successors maintained public lives as Chinese emperors, behind the high walls of their forbidden city, they continued to live as steppe Mongols. When the Franciscan friar Odorico Pordenone visited the Mongol territories in the 1320s, he described the forbidden city in Kandalik. Within the precincts of the said Palace Imperial, there is a most beautiful mount, set and replenished with trees, for which cause it is called the Green Mount, having a most royal and sumptuous palace standing thereupon, in which for the most part the great Khan is resident. In a passage that sounds very close to earlier descriptions of Karakorum, he wrote, "Upon the one side of the said mount there is a great lake, whereupon a most stately bridge is built, in which lake is great abundance of geese, ducks, and all kinds of waterfowl. And in the wood growing upon the mount there is a great store of all birds and wild beasts." The wooden palace built by Kublai Khan seemed to have the same basic plan as the one at Karakorum. Kublai Khan installed mechanical peacocks in his palace. They could spread their tails and cry out in a manner reminiscent of Guillaume Boucher's angel on the silver tree in the palace in Karakorum. Kublai probably brought the magnificent silver tree with him from the Karakorum palace, and he installed at least part of it in Kandalik. As Marco Polo described it, in a certain part of the hall, near where the great Khan holds his table, there is set a large and very beautiful piece of workmanship in the form of a square coffer, or buffet, about 3 paces each way, exquisitely wrought with figures of animals, finely carved and gilt. The internal operation also resembled that of the silver tree. The middle is hollow, and in it stands a great vessel of pure gold, and at each corner of the great vessel is one of similar size. And from the former, the wine or beverage flavored with fine and costly spices is drawn off into the latter. Inside the confines of their forbidden city, Kublai and his family continued to act as Mongols in dress, speech, food, sports, and entertainment. This meant that they consumed large amounts of alcohol, loudly slurped their soup, and they cut meat with knives at the table, thereby disgusting the Chinese, who confined such acts to the kitchen during preparation. With the emphasis on alcohol and rituals of drinking and drunkenness, the scenes at court must have been somewhat chaotic, as the free-roaming, individualistic Mongols tried to imitate the complex and highly orchestrated rituals and ceremonies of the Chinese court. In contrast to the Chinese imperial tradition of courtiers lining up according to rank, the Mongols tended to swarm chaotically. And, perhaps most disturbing to the Chinese, the Mongol women mingled freely among the men on even the most important occasions. The ceremonies in the Mongol court became so disorganized that sometimes the Khan's bodyguards had to beat back the crowds of officials and guests with batons. Like his grandfather, Kublai recognized the importance of laying down a clear and strong legal code as the center of civil administration. Creating and enforcing new laws was the traditional way that steppe chieftains, as well as Chinese rulers, created legitimacy in the eyes of their subjects. In devising a legal code, Kublai did not replace Chinese law with Mongol, so much as reform it to make it compatible with Genghis Khan's law, and in such a way as to simultaneously win support from both his Mongol and Chinese followers. The law was one more weapon in his struggle for loyalty and support from his subjects, and thus ultimately supremacy over the rival Sung dynasty. Kublai Khan's administration guaranteed landowners their property rights, reduced taxes, and improved roads and communications. To further garner public support, the Mongols lessened the harsh penal code of the Sung. The Mongols reduced by nearly half the number of capital offenses in China, from 233 to 135. Kublai Khan rarely allowed the use of execution, even for those offenses that remained. The records of execution survive for all but 4 of the 34 years of his reign. The highest number in a single year was 278 executions in 1283. The lowest was only 7 in 1263. But it is possible that the reason that 4 of the years are missing from the record is because there were no executions at all in those years. In total, fewer than 2,500 criminals were executed in more than 3 decades of Kublai's rule. His annual rate fell considerably short of the number of executions in modern countries, such as China or the United States. Overall, he installed a more consistent system of laws and punishments, as well as one that was substantially milder and more humanitarian than the Sung's. Where practical, he substituted fines for physical punishment, and he installed procedures to grant amnesty to criminals who repented of their wrongdoings. In a similar way, Mongol authorities sought to eradicate torture, or at least to severely curtail its use. Mongol law specified that before torture could be applied to elicit a confession, the officials had to already have substantial evidence, not mere suspicion, that the person had committed a particular crime. The Mongol Legal Code of 1291 specified that officials must first use reason to analyze and surmise, and shall not impose abruptly any torture. By comparison, at the same time that the Mongols were moving to limit the use of torture, both church and state in Europe passed laws to expand its usage to an even greater variety of crimes for which there need be no evidence. Unlike the variety of bloody forms of torture, such as stretching on the rack, being crushed by a great wheel, being impaled on spikes, or various forms of burning in other countries, Mongols limited it to beating with a cane. The mildness of Mongol law and the customs of steppe culture showed up in some odd ways. Chinese authorities frequently tattooed a criminal's crimes on his forehead so that he was permanently marked by his crime. Because Mongols considered the forehead the abode of the soul, they maintained that even a criminal's head could not be thus abused. The Mongol authorities allowed the tattooing to continue where it was already in practice, but specified that the tattoos be placed on the upper arms for the first 2 offenses and on the neck for the 3rd, but never on the forehead. The Mongols did not allow the punishment to be extended into new areas or to ethnic minorities who did not already have the practice. Rather than writing the crime on the body, Mongol authorities preferred to write the offense on a wall erected in front of a criminal's house so that the entire community could watch him carefully. They also used a system of parole in which freed prisoners had to report twice a month to local officials to have their behavior reviewed. In keeping with the Mongol principle of group culpability and responsibility, the freedom of a prisoner depended in part on his willingness to join an auxiliary law enforcement agency in order to apply his knowledge or crime to the apprehension of other prisoners. Criminals, and often their entire families, had to sign documents acknowledging receipt of their sentence and to register their disagreement or complaint with the process. To preserve the record of the event, fingerprints were taken and attached to the document. Whenever practical, Mongol administrators preferred to have as many issues as possible settled at the lowest level without the intervention of officials, Crimes within a family could be settled by the family. Or disputes within a group of monks of the same religion could be settled by monks within that religion. And crimes within a profession could be settled by councils of those professionals. Related to dispute settlement, Mongol authorities encouraged the printing of books on criminology so that individual citizens and these small councils had the benefit of proper guidance. In the area of criminal law, they also set minimum requirements for officials visiting crime scenes to collect, analyze, and report evidence. These included instructions on the handling and examination of a corpse in order to collect as much information from it as practical, the reporting of which had to be made in triplicate, including drawings to depict the location of wounds. The Mongol procedures not only improved the quality of law enforcement, but corresponded with the overarching Mongol policy that all people, not just an educated elite, should know and be able to act through the law. For the Mongols, the law was more a way of handling problems, creating unity, and preserving peace, rather than just a tool for deciding guilt or administering punishment. Instead of educating officials in the classic arts of poetry and calligraphy, Mongols promoted more practical training in a variety of ways. They set minimum standards of knowledge for professions from matchmakers and merchants to doctors and lawyers. On every front, the Mongol policy seemed to be the same. It sought to standardize and raise the level of professions, while at the same time assuring a wide range of individuals access to them and to the benefits and services of the profession. With so few Mongols ruling over so many people in China, Kublai Khan seemed forced to accept administration through the traditional mandarins selected through a long process of study and exams. But he refused. Rather than perpetuate the old system, he abolished the exams and turned, for administrative assistance, to a wide variety of foreigners, particularly Muslims, and when he could get them, Europeans, such as Marco Polo. Like his grandfather, who found the educated Muslim administrators to be skilled in the laws and customs of cities, Kublai imported large numbers of such men from his brother's realm in Persia. He repeatedly sent requests to the Pope and European kings, asking them to send scholars and learned men, but with no response. Mindful of overdependence on any single nationality or ethnic group, and inclined to play one off against another, however, Kublai constantly mixed Chinese and foreigners in a diverse set of administrators that included Tibetans, Armenians, Hitan, Arabs, Tajiks, Uyghurs, Tangut, Turks, Persians, and Europeans. The Mongols staffed each office with an ethnic quota of the three major groups of Northern Chinese, Southern Chinese, and foreigners, so that each official was surrounded by men of a different culture or religion. Just as Genghis Khan promoted men from the lowest levels of society to the highest ranks of leadership based on their skills and achievements rather than birth, Kublai's administration constantly promoted men from the lowest jobs, such as cooks, gatekeepers, scribes, and translators. Both the promotion of low-ranking men and the movement of them into new areas increased their dependence on and loyalty to their Mongol overlords and lessened their connection to the people ruled. Without the rigid hierarchy of the ranked mandarins to administer local areas, Kublai Khan imposed Genghis Khan's system of decisions made through large meetings and councils and constant deliberation. Wherever possible and at whatever level, the Mongols replaced the bureaucracy with councils modeled on the small hurultai of the steppes. The local councils had to meet daily, and any new measure had to come with the seal of approval of at least two officials. The council had to debate the issues and reach a consensus. The decision had to be made by the group, not by a single official. By Chinese standards, This was an extremely inefficient and impractical system that took too much time and energy, compared with simply having one official make the decision and the people follow it. The Mongols promoted the use of other small councils in a variety of ways. Patients displeased with medical service could seek redress from a council composed of representatives of the medical profession and